Hey, this is Doy with Luke, and we're going to be talking a little bit about our Bible readings that we've been going through with our chronological daily Bible. And we are in a section where we're talking about several different names: Ahaziah, Jehoram, and Joash. And what are we going to do with all of these various names? I've asked Luke to join us, and as many of you with Vestavia know, this is kind of in lieu of our Wednesday night Bible classes due to extenuating circumstances. And so we're just going to have a little discussion here and talk a little bit about these particular passages. I want to start, though, by trying to talk for just a moment about our website, because I think if you haven't been utilizing our website, this might be very helpful to you. If you just go to VestaviaChurchOfChrist.com and come under resources, look up under resources here, and then click on Chronological Daily Bible, it will take you to the web page that has all the information and everything we're using for our daily Bible readings. And I just want to draw your attention to the fact that we have several different charts and handouts that are available. And one of the helpful links and resources I've put here is a link to Luke's genealogy page, and he might utilize some of that during our discussion. Has some great helpful links and ideas that help us understand the genealogies better. The weekly summaries are here, and then down at the bottom, the audio for each of the classes that are going on. And so please use the material. Please use the resources that we have on our website. And I think it'll be helpful as we go through some of this. So what I want to do is start by looking at some of these connections in our readings between the names that we're talking about here. So I want to share something else here that is available on the website, and I've passed it out from my classes, and I've just called it Strange Alliances, because it demonstrates this connection here between Israel and Judah during these particular years. And of course, we would add to that, this is also the time frame in which Elijah and Elisha are doing their work as well. But just to kind of see what's happening here, Ahab and Jezebel have a daughter named Athaliah, and she marries Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram. And so by that alliance right there, it connects Judah with Israel really in a way that's not good at all. Athaliah and Jehoram have a son. His name is Ahaziah. And when he dies, Athaliah usurps the throne and reigns for 6 years. And as we're going to see and talk a little bit about in our reading here, Joash is spared by Jehoshaphat and Jehoiada, and then they're able to take the throne back a little bit later. On the side over here under Ahab, you have both Ahaziah and Jehoram. Now, those are not the same men that are on the right side of the chart over here. Ahaziah and Jehoram are both sons of Ahab, and they both reigned. Ahaziah didn't reign very long. When he died, Jehoram took over, and he made an alliance with Ahaziah of Judah. But when Jehu comes along and wipes out the family of Ahab, he's going to kill Joram of Israel, Ahaziah of Judah, and that includes the death of Jezebel as well. So both Judah and Israel basically start over at that point, but unfortunately the starting over point for Judah is Athaliah. So just something to be aware of, and we realize that there's a lot of confusion with some of these names and everything. And I'm going to let Luke explain a little bit from his perspective about some of the work that he's done looking at these names and trying to understand the family connections and all of that, because there's a lot of confusion through these chapters.
Yeah, so first thing I want to do is I'm going to go ahead and share a chart that's on the genealogy site that was noted, that was linked before. This is something that you can download and look at. It's just a PDF file, fits on a single page. You'll notice here we have the Judah and Israel kings that are grouped by their relationship. And a couple things to note here. Let's see here. Let me make it so that it's a little bit easier for you to see what's going on here. All right, so we start, remember, of course, with Jehoshaphat, who we know pretty well, and then Ahab here and Jezebel on the other side. Now, you'll notice that Ahab and Jezebel had three children, Athaliah, Jehoram, and Ahaziah. And both Jehoram and Ahaziah had their chance at the throne in Israel. And so they are not, we tend sometimes to think that every subsequent king has to be a son of the previous king. Well, sometimes you would have brothers reign one after another, so such is the case here. Athaliah, of course, is the one who joins Jehoram. One of the things to watch out for is whenever you have different people listed by multiple names. So you'll find here in this chart, we have some of their alternate names being used. So Jehoshaphat's son, Joram, is also called Jehoram. And this actually adds to the bad alliance that we have going on. Not only did Jehoshaphat join alliance with Ahab, it turns out that they actually named their children the same names. And we don't know who did that first. But I don't know if, I don't think that's by accident. You typically are going to name children off after somebody that you at least want some matter of respect or ties to. And so we find that Ahab and Jehoshaphat named their child the same thing. Now in the text, as you read it, the king's account does a pretty good job of differentiating between whom you're talking about, but you just got to be careful about which one you're talking about. You'll note also that Joram's son, his name is Ahaziah, who is named after his uncle Ahaziah, who is the son again of Ahab. So again, furthers the negative alliances that the two kingdoms are having with each other and the influence that they are having over each other, or rather we could say maybe Athaliah names her son after her brother is another way of looking at that too. All right, so then on down the list, you've got Joash, whom we're going to talk about just a little bit, and Jehoash is his other name. That's going to come into play. Keep in mind that his son Amaziah is not the same name as Ahaziah. It's two different names. And so a couple generations down the line, you're going to want to keep that in note. And then Azariah down here, who's way on down the list, isn't going to be part of our discussions today. He has a very similar name to Ahaziah, but he's not the same name. So just keep that in mind. On the other side now, let's note another Jehoshaphat. And this is not the same Jehoshaphat as the one that's ruling in Judah. This guy is the father of Jehu, and we're going to talk about Jehu today. Now, Jehu, of course, kills off pretty much half the people on the other side of the chart here, and he has a son named Jehoahaz, which is, again, not the same name as any of the ones we've encountered before. However, Jehu's grandson is called Joash or Jehoahash. And so that, again, is confusing because these are kings that are reigning at similar time frames in different nations, different countries. But you got to keep the distinction in mind. And again, the text of Kings will typically say whether or not we're talking about somebody who's in Judah or somebody who's from Israel. And of course, his son, Joash's son, Jeroboam, is a second Jeroboam, not related again to the Jeroboam that began the kingdom of Israel. So we've got a lot of names here going on at the bottom of this. I just go ahead and list a couple of these so that we don't confuse them. We've got two Jehoshaphats, two Jehorams, two Ahaziahs, and two Joashes within these generations. And then also similar names, Jehoram, Jehoahaz, and Jehoash are similar, and Ahaziah, Amaziah, and Azariah are all similar. So you just gotta, if it helps, highlight, if it helps to go ahead and keep your own record of who we're talking about when, but this chart is available for you through the genealogy site if it's needed.
Yeah, we can add to that that there was another Jehu as well, who was a prophet who rebuked Jehoshaphat for making these alliances. So again, you know, as confusing as that can be, we can maybe remember that today it's not uncommon for people to name somebody David or Jim or John or something like that, and you have many people with the very same name. So that's not an uncommon phenomenon. These are just a little different names than we're used to is all. Well, let's go ahead and then and consider the events that are happening at this particular time. We might remember kind of a little bit of the backstory here, that Ahab and Jehoshaphat had made this alliance. I preached this last Sunday, in fact, about the idea that, you know, who you ally yourself with really does matter. And this is one of those evidences of that. And the reason for that is because there are, you know, unintended consequences. I don't think that anybody would say that Jehoshaphat wanted these things to happen that happen after his, you know, after he's gone. He didn't try to make it happen. He's called a good man. He tries to do what's right. You know, he's following the Lord, but this is his one wicked vice. And the problem with that, of course, is it has horrendous consequences. So in that battle, 2 Chronicles 18, 1 Kings 22 both talk about, for Ramoth-Gilead, of course, Ahab dies. Jehoshaphat is then rebuked, but it sets up the events that we're looking at right here, and the subsequent issues that are going to happen. And so now you have Jehoram, after Jehoshaphat's gone, you have Jehoram reigning in Judah, and Ahaziah is reigning in Israel initially here. Then, of course, those names are going to switch in as far as who's reigning where. They're the same names, different people. But I do want to notice, though, in the text, and this is the 2 Kings chapter 8, that even though when Jehoram begins to reign in Judah, down in verse 16, it says he was 32 years old, he reigned 8 years. Verse 18 says he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done. For the daughter of Ahab became his wife, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. However, the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah for the sake of David his servant, since he had promised him to give a lamp to him through his sons always. A couple things strike me about this. Number one is most of the kings are going to be compared to David, you know, good or bad. But in this case, Jehoram walks in the ways of Ahab. Well, that doesn't surprise us because of the fact that he marries Ahab's daughter. But what's really important here, I believe, is verse 19. It says, the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah for the sake of David, since he had promised to give him a lamp through his sons always. Why did God treat the kings of Judah differently from the way he treated the kings of Israel? And I think this is our answer right here, that God was still operating on the basis of a covenant promise that he had made to David. He wasn't going to wipe out that line. And I think one of the driving forces of this narrative is when we finally do come down to this point where Athaliah takes over and nearly wipes out the lineage here, and only Joash is spared. Really, I think the driving force here is how is God going to carry out his plan? How is he going to spare the lineage if he's going to keep the promises? So I still think that the promises of God really are the driving force behind what we're reading in these texts right here.
And not just the promises too, but also the commandments as well. One of the things that I just want to note before we proceed is there is actually going to be reason to come back to 2 Kings chapter 8 and the story there between verses 7 and 15 with Elisha basically setting up the successor to Ben-Hadad, of course, is not even part of the Israelite or Judah story. He's going to have significant influence by the end of our stories today. And one of the interesting things is that there's going to be a couple texts that indicate that these things are happening to fulfill what God had spoken to Elijah all the way back in 1 Kings chapter 19, that there will be successors of the kings of Aram, and there's going to be successors in the line of Israel. And all the way back in 1 Kings chapter 19, God actually charged Elijah with establishing the successor, Hazael, over Ben-Hadad. And he also charges Elijah with establishing Jehu as king as well. And these things happened long before, generations now, before these people probably were even born. I don't know if we can argue exactly how long we are going back to 1 Kings 19. But these things are all according to God's plans. His commandments and his promises are all being fulfilled throughout this text here.
Right, and again, when we think about what drives the narrative here, this is still not just so much the history of Israel, but the history of how God is operating through these events. Once again, we're seeing the idea that as wicked as the people are, God is still able to overcome that and carry out the plans that he made from the very beginning here. Of course, we also note this is a time when Edom is revolting down in verse 20. And, so you've got a lot of problems. Edom rebelling, Libna, which is in the land there, rebelling. And so things are not really going well for Judah under Jehoram. And I think that's important. Things went a lot better under Jehoshaphat. And I think primarily because Jehoshaphat did generally overall seek the Lord. Now, when Jehoram dies then, Ahaziah takes the throne, and this is still in Judah. So in 2 Kings 8, 24 through the end of that chapter.
This is again Ahaziah, the son of Joram, not Ahaziah, the son of Ahab.
Right, yeah. And again, to keep that distinction in mind. So what happens then is that now you're going to have the situation where Ahaziah is ruling in Judah and Jehoram is ruling in Israel. And Jehoram, the son of Ahab, is ruling in Israel. So you got those two men now. And now comes along this guy by the name of Jehu. And as you mentioned, he was selected by God to do what he was going to do. And I really believe that had Jehu chosen the right path, he could have really turned things around for Israel. I mean, he could have wiped out the lineage of Ahab and then started everything fresh, and it would have been a different story.
Well, God does, based on what Jehu is able to accomplish in these chapters, he does give Jehu the lion's share of the kingship over Israel. I don't think anybody else is able to quite match how many generations sat on the throne that Jehu had. And of course, that wasn't due to his great personal moral value, but it was because of the service that he was able to offer. And of course, if God blessed Jehu for simply doing what he was commanded, how much more could he have been blessed if he had actually sought God out his whole reign?
And yeah, I think Jehu, of all the kings of Israel, comes the closest to being a better king, but he's in the end going to come up short again and turn back to the idols. I'm looking in 2 Kings chapter 9, and in verse 14, Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, and again, let's clarify, this Jehoshaphat is a different Jehoshaphat. So Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. Now, which Joram is he conspiring against here? Well, this would be the Joram of Israel, right? So King Joram has been defending Ramoth-Gilead, which is what Ahab was trying to do, was get Ramoth-Gilead back when he died. And he returned to Jezreel. He had been wounded in this battle. He returns to Jezreel, and Jehu rides in his chariot up to Jezreel and says Joram was lying there. And who had come to see Joram but Ahaziah of Judah? So now you've got the whole situation set up here for Jehu to take care of this. And they recognize that, you know, Jehu was coming and everything, and ask him, this is down in verse 16, a horseman went to meet him and said, "Thus says the king, is it peace?" And Jehu said, "What have you to do with peace? Turn behind me." The watchman reported, "The messenger came to them, but he did not return." sent out a second horseman who came to him. Is it peace? And he, you know, the same thing right happens right there. So Joram then decides he needs to try to take off, basically. And down in verse 21, he says, get ready. And they made his chariot ready. And Joram of Israel and Ahaziah, king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot. They went out to meet Jehu, found him in the property of Naboth, the Jezreelite. And when Joram saw Jehu, he says, is it peace, Jehu? And he answered, what peace, so long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many? So Joram reigned about and fled and said to Ahaziah, there is treachery, O Ahaziah. And Jehu drew his bow full strength and shot Joram between his arms. The arrow went through his heart, sank in, and he sank into his chariot. And Jehu said to Bidkar, his officer, take him up, cast him into the property of the field of Naboth, the Jezreelite. For I remember when you and I were riding together after Ahab, his father, that the Lord laid his oracle against him. Isn't that interesting? That Jehu is remembering something that the Lord had said here. And he says in verse 26, surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son, says the Lord, and I will repay you in his property. Now then, take and cast him into the property according to the word of the Lord. So this is in fulfillment of what God had indicated. So Joram tries to run, and Jehu draws his bow and kills him, and he dies in his chariot right there, and they're going to put him in the field of Naboth. Now, what happens to Ahaziah? Where's he going to go? Well, down in verse 27, Ahaziah saw this. He fled. Jehu pursued him, and he got as far as the city of Megiddo, which is interesting. Of course, Megiddo is known for its great battles and all of that. So basically, Ahaziah made it up the Jezreel Valley a good ways toward the coast before Jehu finally, had his effect on him and Ahaziah died.
Probably the greatest car chase of the Bible, right?
Yeah. And then Jehu is known for his chariot driving. So now you got the king of Judah dead. You have the king of Israel dead. And yet Jezebel and Athaliah are both living. And so now we find that Jehu then comes back to Jezreel, where Jezebel was. And we got this great little story here in verse 30 of 2 Kings 9, where Jezebel hears about this. She paints her eyes, adorns her head, looks out the window. And as Jehu enters the gate, she said, is it well, Zimri, your master's murderer? Now, you know, what's interesting about that is what she's doing, of course, is basically doing a little bit of trash talking. We all remember that Zimri was the weak king. I mean, he lasted 1 week. He tried to make a coup. And in reality, the people chose Omri over Zimri. And, of course, Zimri ended up killing himself, setting fire to the palace and dying there. So Zimri is an insult. And so by her doing this, she's calling Jehu Zimri. She's trying to convey this idea that this is an ill-conceived coup and he's not going to last. But he lifts up his face to the window and said, who's on my side? Who? And two of the three officials looked down at him and he said, throw her down. So they threw her down. Some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall, on the horses, and he trampled under her underfoot. She's thrown down, and that's bad enough, of course, but then he drives over her, basically, runs her over. I wonder if he even backed up over her two or three times or something. But he recognizes she's a cursed woman, bury her, you know, she's a king's daughter, so go ahead and bury her, but basically the dogs had already come and eaten her up. So it's not a good ending for Jezebel.
One of the interesting things that I see as a thread throughout here is that the common the common person in these nations, or in Israel and Judah, they could tell, I think, that this was coming. I mean, you notice how many individuals chose to side with Jehu. There's something about Jehu that had a leader character to him. All the way back from when Jehu was first called at the beginning of chapter 9, what we find is that he's just one among many commanders. But when the prophet comes in and he tells Jehu in private, "You're going to be king," and then he runs out, Jehu comes out of the tent, and the other commanders who are equals with him, they come out and they ask him, "Hey, what was that guy talking about?" And Jehu said, "Well, he told me I'm going to be king." What was their reaction? It wasn't to fight, to fuss, or to go complain to, you know, to their leaders, "Hey, look, Jehu's going to be an insurrectionist. He's trying to get over top of us." No, they say they hurried and took their own garments and placed it under him and said, "Jehu is king." They're eager to see a new king. They're eager to see Jehu as a king. And you know, whenever he goes out and he calls out to each of the messengers, it says, just, "Why are you even bothering serving these guys? Come follow me instead." And look how eager every individual is to do it, even to the servants here who throw Jezebel down. They can tell that there's something wrong with the alliance and with the service to the gods of Baal. I don't know how each of these individuals would have been wanting to honor God per se, but they knew that this was coming. And I think it had become evident to everybody who lives there, this was not a good situation, and anybody knew was going to be better than what they had under Jezebel.
And I think that, you know, you see the zeal that Jehu has, because the deaths of Joram and Ahaziah and Jezebel, that's not the end of it. Now you get into chapter 10, and you have a fuller judgment on the house of Ahab, because he still has, you know, what, 70 sons, and so a bunch of other people that are left, and Jehu sets out to eradicate everything. And in verse 11 of 2 Kings 10, we read that Jehu killed all who remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men and his acquaintances and his priests, until he left him without a survivor. Now, of course, we know there's one exception to that. And, you know, I have often wondered, why is it that Jehu didn't pursue Athaliah with the same zeal and take her down? But he didn't, and so she's the one who survives, basically. And you know, in Jezreel and up in the north, there were no survivors. But Athaliah has gone south, so maybe that's part of it. But of course, that is going to wreak havoc on Judah.
And you keep in mind that Athaliah had basically fortified herself inside of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was a very difficult city to take. Jehu is basically preying on surprise here. Notice how many people he just catches off guard, and it's all a really fast, really quick thing. He even does it to the relatives who come up there in chapter 10 and verse 13. They're relatives of Ahaziah, and they are caught off guard by Jehu too, and he wipes them out too. It says nobody quite sees it coming, but when word gets back down to Jerusalem, he's not going to be able to surprise attack Athaliah in Jerusalem. It's basically going to be very difficult for him now to get at her. And unfortunately, what we find is that his zeal ultimately is short-lived. His zeal is eradicating and getting all this bloodbath here. And I kind of wonder, what is he zealous for? Is he being zealous for the Lord? Or is he being zealous because he's a warmonger? And I kind of wonder if his desire for all this is really because he just likes to kill people. And God, of course, uses him because he's well-suited to this task. But he does not pursue Athaliah, perhaps because he feels like, well, you know what? I've already got all this over with. I might as well set up my kingdom now and just not really bother with Athaliah.
Well, maybe Jehu and Joab would have gotten along pretty well. But Jehu now, he's still not done, of course. He tries to wipe out the family of Ahab, and then begins to destroy Baal worshipers And so, and again, in 2 Kings chapter 10, 18 and following, they basically eradicate. Verse 28 actually says, Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel. Now, that's a pretty tall order, because Jezebel, under her influence with Ahab, had essentially made Baal worship the national religion.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but was Baal still active down in Judah for a while? Is this statement basically just making a statement for the northern?
I think so, yeah. He apparently didn't get down into the south, so... Yeah,
but I guess we can attribute Athaliah with bringing in Baal worship to the south.
Yeah, okay. she brought it down there. But you know what? The context of Jehu is the north. So he eradicates Baal out of Israel, verse 28. So that's not talking about Judah here. So the question then is, well, what about Jehu made him so wicked after this? Well, and the answer is, verse 29, as for the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin, from these Jehu did not depart, even the golden calves at Bethel and Dan. Which is, I think, kind of interesting that apparently those idols are still standing. They're still at those places after all these years. Maybe it's become a, you know, national icon for the people. I don't know. But verse 31 then says that Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel sin. So on the one hand, you might say, well, that was better than what Ahab was doing. He was, you know, he wasn't as bad as Ahab. But at the same time, remember that Jeroboam's sins put Israel on this path to begin with. And you know, that's why God took out Jeroboam. So Jehu, unfortunately, though he learned the lessons from Ahab, he didn't learn the lessons about Jeroboam, and that's going to spell out trouble for him. Although, like you said, he has a longer dynasty than the others. And so by the end of chapter 10, Jehu dies. But he reigned over Israel for 28 years. So that brings us then to the situation in Judah. So we're kind of moving back over to Judah now. And Athaliah, you know, after Ahaziah dies, Athaliah seizes upon the opportunity and she takes the throne. And again, there's a lot of killing that goes on here. You know, when Jehoram of Judah became king, he tried to kill his brothers. You know, they're learning these kinds of things from Ahab and Jezebel. And now Athaliah, she becomes queen and takes over, basically, and begins to try to put to death her own grandchildren to secure her throne. So this is the definition of abject wickedness. Just, you know, no heart for God, no heart for family. All she wants is power, scary beyond all reason. I mean, that's what we're looking at here with someone like, Athaliah. So, what do we know about, Joash then?
He doesn't have a lot of good role models. And, As it turns out, you know, one of his best role models ends up being I believe it's his aunt and his uncle. Let me do this real quick while we got it up here. I'm going to take you over to my genealogy site here, and what I want to point out is we've got this family line. Let me make this easier to see for you here. All right, so we've got this family line, of course, Ahab, and how they married into the family. But notice that this is Joash that we're going to be talking about here, the young king here. And Athaliah, of course, is way over here. And she's the one that births Ahaziah. Right here we have mentioned in chapter 11, verse 2, Ahaziah's sister, Jehosheba. And she is the one that's actually going to take and save Joash. So she rescues her nephew from the hands of Athaliah, and she is married to Jehoiada the priest. And Jehoiada is going to be Joash's number one role model. And Jehoiada is almost going to act as an interim king while Joash is being trained. And so he actually is a priest. So we assume, and we know rather, that he is from Levi somewhere. We don't know exactly how he ties in, but he's part of the family of Aaron. But he actually does marry into this kingly family. And that's not all that uncommon. But I think it's interesting to have that connection there. We might normally see him as being disconnected from the family, but he actually almost has right to reign as a king. Joash, of course, has a supremacy in that position. And so his actions as an interim king are not uncalled for in that situation.
And of course, one of the contrasts there is the fact that Jehoiada was a good man. Jehoiada did what was right. And so this is not an example of someone trying to usurp the throne in an ungodly kind of way. What Jehoiada and Jehoshaphat do is they spare the rightful king. Well, the reason that they have to do it this way is because Joash is only about a year old here. It's not like he could have done anything about that or would have even known what was going on at this particular point. But they're going to take Joash and spare him from Athaliah for some 6 years, and then they'll take care of the situation. So in the seventh year that Athaliah has been reigning, they basically, with the help of the guards and everything else, stage a coronation. And they're going to bring Joash out to the temple, basically, to the grounds, and they're going to have this coronation and proclaim him to be king. And, you know, Athaliah is going to hear a bunch of noise and try to figure out what in the world is going on. When she goes out to see what's going on, Jehoiada basically says, go ahead and take her. And they took her, of course, and dispatched with her pretty quickly. And
do you think Athaliah knew that Joash was still alive? We're not told whether or not she was made aware that he was spared or not, but you can imagine she's not like she was analyzing DNA testing of bodies or anything. And so in all the slaughter, you would imagine she might have thought she got them all.
Yeah, and part of the question is, was she the one personally doing all this, or was she sending her own henchmen out to do it? And in which case, you know, it wouldn't have been that hard to miss one if they're spared. And so, you're right. It's hard to say. She doesn't really know. But I think suffice it to say that this particular event she was not expecting. And to proclaim this young boy a king, he's only 7 years old at this point. And when she comes out, they get hold of her, they put her to death. And then we drop down. I want to drop down to verse 17 in 2 Kings 11. Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people, that they would be the Lord's people, also between the king and the people. And all the people of the land went to the house of Baal and tore it down, his altars and his images. They broke in pieces thoroughly and killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. And the priest appointed officers over the house of the Lord. So now what you have is a kind of a revival, again, of the people. Bring them back to the Lord and get things reestablished once again. Make a new covenant with God once again to be his people. And, of course, Joash, being as young as he is, probably has little to say at this particular point. But the stage is set for Joash to have a really great reign if he applies himself to that. And as he begins reigning in Judah in chapter 12, how long does he do what's right? Well, verse 2 says, Jehoash did right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Now, the high places weren't taken away. You know, the high places are notoriously difficult to get rid of. They keep coming back, you know. and the people were still trying to sacrifice and do all that kind of stuff, but they're trying to get things restored. And even the temple is going to be, you know, they're going to try to restore the temple and get that back to where it's supposed to be as well. So you have this, you know, this period of time in which they're drawing near back to the Lord and trying to do what's right, getting everything set back up and all of that. But unfortunately, that's not going to be enough, because Jehoash is going to turn once again after Jehoiada's gone.
I find it interesting in these in this short revival, almost, about the temple. Of course, Jehoiada wants Jehoash, which is the same as Joash. He wanted for funds to be collected so that the temple could be repaired, and that's a good endeavor. Turns out, we don't know exactly how long it was, but it was 23 years into his own reign, he took a look at the temple and realized it's kind of out of order. And he asks the priest, he says, and he asks Jehoiada, and he says, why is the temple not in order? Why didn't you repair everything like we wanted it to? And so then they had to... they thought, well, we did take a collection. Where did that money go? Basically, it looks like it went into the pockets of the priests, and they just took the money. And so Jehoiada, and really it's by the instigation of Joash here, he had to prod them to say, you guys need to do what's right with this money. So the priest agreed, okay, in verse 8, was, all right, we won't take any more money. We'll go ahead and do what we're supposed to have done with the money the first time around. And they finally repaired the temple, created the utensils, you know, made sure everything was put back to right. But I wonder if that's even, you know, maybe with Jehoiada being as good of a man as he was, he had a tough time himself taking care of the temple like he should have. I mean, it almost seems like Jehoiada did a better job taking care of the kingship than he did taking care of the temple.
Well, and again, if he would not have had the support of the government, as it were, he didn't have support of Athaliah, certainly.
Well, but I'm saying this is after 23 years. I'm kind of curious what's going on for these 20-some years.
Well, you're right, and it's difficult to know exactly. And it could just be an overwhelming situation. Things had gotten so bad in Judah,
yeah.
It took all he had to take care of the kingdom. That would be my best guess as to why that's happening that way. Well, as we come into chapter 13, and we'll just take a couple more minutes here. We come into chapter 13, and we have the description of the sons of Jehu in the dynasty there, Jehoahaz and then Jehoash. And as you mentioned, this Jehoash was not the same. So... Jehoahaz and Jehoash, and there's not a lot to say about them, because in reality, they both just did evil. Verse 2 of chapter 13, talking about Jehoahaz, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, followed the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. He did not turn from them, so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And here's kind of what you had mentioned before. He gave them continually into the hand of Hazael, king of Aram, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael. So now the Syrians are back, the Arameans, and causing all kinds of problems for Israel up in the north. And in this case, it's interesting because Jehoahaz did ask for favor from the Lord, and God gave it to him. God listened to him, and he took away that oppression. In fact, I think it's interesting, in verse 5, it says, the Lord gave Israel a deliverer. That's kind of like the judges period, you know, and instead of Jehoahaz being the deliverer, there's somebody else involved here. But again, even with all that, they didn't turn away from the sins of Jeroboam. And so again, when Jehoahaz died, his son Joash or Jehoash became king, And same thing, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, verse 11 says, and he didn't turn away from all the sins of Jeroboam. And that's about all we have with him in this particular text. We'll save really the class discussion. We'll talk about Jeroboam later, the second Jeroboam. But let's just talk for just a moment real quickly here about the end of chapter 13, the death of Elisha. And, one of the contrasts here, of course, is, Elijah never actually died, was simply taken, by God. But Elisha becomes sick, and it says with the illness of which he was to die. And then Joash came down to him and wept over him, it says. And this is Joash of Israel, in fact. And says, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And it's interesting that even these men who were so wicked, they still have a certain amount of respect for someone like Elisha as he's about to die. And so Elisha said, take a bow and arrow. He took a bow and arrow, and he said to the king of Israel, put your hand on the bow. He did that, opened the window, and then shoot. And he shot it, and the Lord's arrow of victory, it says, even the arrow of victory over Aram, for you will defeat the Arameans at Aphek until you have destroyed them. And he said, take the arrows and strike the ground. He struck it three times. The man of God was angry and said, you should have struck five or six times. And you would have struck Aram until they would have destroyed them. But now you shall strike Aram only three times. Again, kind of an interesting thing there. Maybe Joash wasn't, all that excited about the way he was doing this. But anyway, it ends, of course, by saying that they would at least defeat Aram here. And when Elisha died, then we read about the Moabites invading the land. And verse 21 says, they were burying a man, and behold, they saw a marauding band, and they cast the man into the grave of Elisha. And when the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. And Hazael, king of Aram, had oppressed Israel all these days and so forth. So just this little vignette about this guy who gets thrown into the tomb, basically, of Elisha. And when he touches Elisha, he revives. Interesting little thing there, because I think it does, in fact, kind of foreshadow this idea that the people of God would one day rise. And so we end that chapter. The Syrians are back, the Moabites are back, and unfortunately, Judah has kind of turned back in a bad way. And both north and south, once again, are really not doing terribly well at this point. So do you have any final thoughts you want to add to any of this?
Well, I was just thinking about the reign of Joash. And to me, he's one of the most disappointing of characters, just because he has such a good opportunity. And to me, one of the saddest things about the description in chapter 12 is you spend all this time and all this money to rejuvenate the temple and the utensils of the temple. And then what does he do in verse 18? It says when Hazael starts to oppress, he gets scared and he sends off all of the utensils and all the things that had become sacred to the temple and to that he had made and that his father had made and that Jehoiada had made. And he just sends them off, hoping that he can, get rid of Hazael here. And to me, that is a signifier of his lack of trust. And he's almost throwing away his entire upbringing, his childhood, and being raised by a priest. He would have had knowledge of these utensils and how they were to be used in the law. And he's just throwing all that away. And sometimes when we start to disrespect how we serve God, because that's what he's doing here. He's getting rid of their capacity to serve God honorably. And so it shows his own personal lack of trust that God's going to help them. And I wonder how often those two go together. When we start to disregard our proper respect and worship for God and his commandments with our own lack of trust, that he's able to do what he's promised.
Well, and that's a good point. These lessons remind us how far things can go astray when we quit trusting in the Lord. There are little glimpses of faith demonstrated, Jehoshaphat, Jehoiada, Joash to an extent. But for whatever reason, they keep reverting back to the idolatry and back to the sins of their forefathers. And it just, again, wreaks havoc on the nation. Well, I appreciate the time, appreciate the opportunity to be able to do this. And what I would say to the classes at this point is just keep reading. Keep reading. Yeah, some of it can be a little confusing with all the names and all that. But we're trying to put together stuff that helps in that. But just keep reading, and God will bless you. Thank you.